This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, wrapping up our annual producer pick series, and this is a time of the year when people who work behind the scenes step in front of the microphone to share their favorite segments from the past year. Today, we hear from our oldest and newest producers, Katie Barron and Laura Pelliser. First up is Katie Barron, veteran, we should say, not older, a veteran of the show, all the way back to 2006 and came out of retirement this year to help us out. We're very happy to see her back. Gone for a while, moving around the country, raising kids, you know, doing all that important stuff. But what's more important than producing for the State of Things? And so she's back here since August. So happy to have you back, Katie. It's great to have you here. Welcome back.
It's great to be back, Frank. Thanks for inviting me to come back.
Well, it's great. And, you know, some things have changed, I'm sure, and some things have not at all, I guess.
I would say a lot has changed. Mostly a lot.
Mostly a lot. Well, anyway, but what we still do is ask you to look back at the year and tell us some of your favorites. And I know you've only been back for a few months. You didn't have a lot to choose from. What'd you pick?
Yeah, that's right. Well, speaking of things that have changed, I am now at the stage, as you mentioned, of having children and school-age children at that. So the first clip or story that I chose was about Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools. That's where I went to school in the 80s and 90s. And this is I wouldn't say it's my favorite story because it's not a happy story, but it is top of mind because of my life stage. It's a story about the lawsuit that ended busing as a way to force integration. It was the 45th anniversary of the Supreme Court's decision in Swan versus Charlotte Mecklenburg. The guests were journalist Adam Rue and Julian Wright, who is an attorney in Charlotte who served on the public schools equity committee for a number of years.
And this, of course, was the court's decision to use busing to force integration of Charlotte public schools, right?
That's right. And then in 1999, they overturned that decision and Charlotte went back to a neighborhood school system. And so, here's what happened.
Yeah, it was pretty remarkable. Right after Judge Potter's decision, Fannie Flono, who was a columnist for the Charlotte Observer and wrote frequently on education, wrote a column, and I want to quote it just because we talked about it in the article. She said, "Neighborhood schools will inevitably bring resegregated schools to many sections of Charlotte. For poor black communities, that will mean concentrated poverty schools. So far, no city with such resegregation has been able to make such schools flourish." And she nailed it. That's exactly what happened. Part of the challenge here is that school policy is housing policy, and housing policy is school policy in Charlotte. And we have, for the most part, relatively segregated neighborhoods. And so when you move to a neighborhood-based school assignment plan, inevitably you've got pockets of white families and pockets of black families. And so the neighborhood school is going to reflect those communities. And that's exactly what happened. If you look at the data, a third of CMS schools, they have 168 campuses, and a third of them are segregated by poverty. Half are segregated by race, and a fifth are hyper-segregated by race, which is 90% of the students come from one particular race. So really a remarkable swing over essentially a 15-year period.
Julian Wright, you served on the Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools Equity Committee in the aftermath of that lawsuit. Tell us why that was set up and what you saw as chair of that committee or a member of that committee.
That committee was set up to help the school board try to determine if they were in fact providing equitable educational opportunities for all students. As Adam pointed out, Mrs. Flano and others in the community pointed out that if you go to a controlled choice type of student assignment plan, you run the risk that students are going to be segregated or hyper-segregated by race or by socioeconomic status. And the goal of the Equity Committee was to try to make sure that schools had the appropriate resources to address the educational needs of the students that were assigned to a particular school. So if a high-poverty school needed more teacher aides or needed more reading tutors or needed more and different kind of books in the library, the goal was to make sure that the resources that would be needed in each individual school were there. Folks were pretty clear that equity did not mean congruent. It didn't mean exactly the same. Kids didn't need exactly the same resources to be able to be reached educationally at their location. But the goal of the Equity Committee was to try to monitor and make sure that resources were provided throughout the system so that educational opportunities were equitable.
And how did it work out?
unabashedly, what we determined during the 5 or 6 years that I served on the committee, we concluded that while valiant attempts were made, particularly with resources, with hard resources, with computers and books, I think the school system did an admirable job of trying to shuffle resources. But what was clear was that equitable educational opportunities were not being provided, and certainly equitable educational outcomes weren't being reached. And throughout that 5 or 6 year period, you saw an increasing isolation within the school system as more and more schools began to get higher concentrations of one race or the other, higher concentrations of poverty were lumped into different schools. And we would lament every year in our report to the Board of Education that this was happening. But at the time, other than, you know, again, attempting to move around hard resources, books, desks, computers, some consideration of where schools were going to be placed. But for the most part, the trend towards desegregation and towards a dividing up of how students were performing based on where they lived became more and more prevalent.
So that was journalist Adam Rue and attorney Julian Wright talking about the state of public education in Charlotte 45 years after the Supreme Court's decision in Swan versus the Board of Education. And that was one of producer Katie Barron's favorite segments that she produced this year, a kind of cautionary tale for public education, and it sort of has good news and bad news. I mean, the idea that the school system at first embraced it, and then obviously there's the reaction, and then we're sort of always fighting this pendulum battle.
I think it wasn't in that clip, but Adam did talk about how Charlotte did embrace the busing plan and the integration of its schools, and it was a real source of pride for the community. Of course, I was a child at the time, wasn't really paying attention to the politics of it all, but I do remember the community pride.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Then when you embrace it, it just makes it a lot easier. Then the backlash, the same in Wake County, they had the best school systems once they embraced it. And then, of course, the backlash created serious problems. And then they claimed it wasn't racism, but I think time will tell. So here we are. What else did you choose?
So in keeping with this theme of public education, I also chose a conversation with Keisha Daniels. She's director of a consulting firm called Thinking Maps that applies brain research to classroom learning.
Let's listen.
Where I think maybe we've gone wrong a bit is historically, we know that education didn't always start out like how we are traditionally used to going to school. So somewhere along the line, when we became an industrialized nation, we decided that in 6.5 hours a day, 180 days a year, children had to learn certain things, or else something maybe wasn't quite right. Right? It kind of dropped them off into this deficit way of thinking. However, that's really not how we learn. We know that there are things that take us adults, children, everyone in between, lots more time to really understand. And so I think this idea of truncating education into a percentage of time and or a standard measurement leads us to focus more on getting things done as opposed to really helping children think about how to think about learning and how do we think about these topics. Teachers will tell you, I don't have time. Because we have to get this done in this year in order to move them on to the next thing. So that's an interesting piece.
Well, you talk about higher orders of thinking. And so if we're talking about levels, we should perhaps think about those orders of thinking rather than a kind of calendar. Tell us about those orders of thinking. What do you mean?
Yeah, so what we like to think about in education ease, I like to say, are these taxonomies of learning. And largely the taxonomies fall into two main ideas of thinking, Bloom's taxonomy and then Webb's depth of knowledge. And it's probably easier to tell you more about what higher orders of thinking are not. And largely those fall into the recall and the low levels of understanding. Recall is at its very basic, just that. Recall a time, recall a name, recall an idea. Whereas higher orders of thinking really get into having children metacognitively think about their thinking and to be able to create new ways of thinking, analyze someone's thinking, apply their learning to a new situation, strategic and extended ways of thinking. And largely, we sometimes focus too much on those lower levels, and there's not enough of the higher levels that are embedded into our day-to-day teaching styles.
So let's talk about the value of this. You mentioned something called metacognitive thinking, which is to say watching me think. So it's one thing. So I present a child with a problem, and they solve it. Now, what you're asking them at this metacognitive level is say, how did you do that? Think
exactly
about how you did that so that you can return to that. You can use that process again should you have a similar problem.
Absolutely. And it also speaks to not just think about it, but tell me about it. How did you arrive at that problem? And what were you thinking about when you got to that problem? Can you help a friend think differently about a problem? That's a very higher order way of thinking.
So that was a portion of a conversation with Keisha Daniels that first aired back in August of this year. Keisha is the director of consulting for a group called Thinking Maps, and our conversation with her was one of producer Katie Barron's picks for a favorite segment of the year. What'd you like about that segment?
Yeah, well, like I said, I think it was great grounding for the start of the school year to keep in mind the big picture, what we really hope our children will learn. Teaching these kinds of skills is so important, and I'm not sure that we start it soon enough. And it may not have been in that clip, but Keisha goes on to give an example of how even elementary school age children can understand conflict and competition for resources and think about ways to resolve those problems. And that's really fundamental.
Good stuff. That comes from Mom, Katie Barron, Mom and producer Katie Barron on The State of Things. We're listening back to old shows, ones that were chosen by our producers. And we will hear more from Katie Barron just ahead. Also, our newest producer, Laura Pelliser, will join the program to find out what her favorite picks are. And you will hear it on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. My guest in the studio, for part of this hour anyway, is Katie Barron, one of our producers of this show, and she is highlighting some of the segments that she worked on since she rejoined our team back in August, talking about her favorites. What else do you have for us?
Yeah, well, I thought I would balance out the public radio broccoli that I just fed to you.
Radio broccoli. Let's explain that, because this is something we talk about in the meetings frequently.
Yes, it's good for you. Yeah. It may not be fun, but it's healthy, right, and you need to digest it sometimes.
The word service always comes up when we talk about the broccoli segments that we think we should do.
Exactly. It's a good public service. So I've done that. Can check that box. Let's move on to some of the more fun things that I chose. I decided to highlight three female artists and that I found inspiring and wanted to bring some extra attention to their work in case our listeners missed it the first time. First one is a writer, Christine Hale. She's a novelist who lives in Asheville, but her most recent book is a memoir. It is about coming to terms with some of her life trauma that and one of the things that helped her was Buddhist meditation. I was skeptical of this when it landed on my desk, but Christine was warm. She was funny, humble. I really enjoyed speaking with her. And one of the funniest things about it was her take on her Buddhist teacher. You can imagine, after listening to her, what a character this woman was.
Let's listen to Christine Hale.
Yes, I had been interested in Buddhism, in stories and so forth for many years, but I had not practiced Buddhism until I stumbled into it during the first year of the divorce. And curiously, it was my ex-husband who found the Buddhist group and asked me to take the children there when he went out of town, and I did, and I'm the one who stuck with it. What the Tibetan Buddhist practice provided for me was a place to be still. To sit down on the cushion and to chant, which is the essence of Tibetan Buddhism, required me to stop running around like a frightened maniac, at least for the hour or two that I was there. And one stills the body in Tibetan Buddhism and all forms of Buddhism so that insights may arise. And that's what Buddhism did for me. But along the way, I acquired this Buddhist teacher, a female Buddhist teacher. I came to understand eventually that she was kind of an odd mother to me, not a friendly mother, but one who really put my feet in the fire and caused me to start looking at my life rather than running from it.
Well, that sounds, and again, I think that's, you put your finger on a very important point here. Earlier, you talked about being still and confronting this, and there's a kind of romantic, almost, a placid view of allowing things to finally melt away. But it's difficult in that moment, isn't it? I mean, there's a reason we run from these things. They're painful.
Yes.
What was it like when you first sat down and let these things happen in your mind?
Well, when any of us is faced with a terrible life trauma, it is the feeling that it will never end, the fear that it will never end, that is almost worse than the thing itself. And so that the practice then helps one experience the passage of time and that it changes.
I've already experienced the pain. I don't have to continue to suffer.
Yes.
You talked about the importance of your teacher through this process and how they may have guided you, she may have guided you in those difficult moments. Maybe you could read a passage about your teacher from your memoir.
Yes, I have just a little bit here that captures the essence of her, I believe. I have a Buddhist teacher, and she describes herself this way. I just old lady. Next comes a chuckle that might or might not be tongue-in-cheek. She never reveals her exact age. My guess is she's somewhere between 80 and 90 years old. She came of age like the rest of the dwindling number of still-living Tibetan lamas exiled by the Chinese takeover in 1959, as an aristocrat in a feudal theocracy. Her form is stolid and lumpy, layered in many colors and textures of thrift store sweatpants, skirt, undershirt, and sweater. Her breathing is often audibly labored. Her English is limited, but her mind, her wit, and her tongue are razor-sharp. For the first years I tried to follow her, she did not acknowledge me. For some years after that, I had no name she claimed to remember. When asking others to fetch me, she referred to me in a tone of mild derision as writer lady. When she did finally begin to address me directly, it was only to pound me each and every time with a single horrifying question, "What you do wrong?"
That was Christine Hale. She's a writer. She was talking about her memoir, A Piece of Sky, A Grain of Rice, a conversation produced by Katie Barron and selected as one of her favorites this year. And, of course, you can find out more about her at ChristineHaleBooks.com. I'm with you, Katie. I mean, we always, you know, have to judge carefully and do some real careful discernment on the show. You know, there are people who have these stories, and if they fall into a category kind of feel a little too new agey to us, something that we've heard it too often before. We're careful, but there's something so fresh and earnest about her voice and funny, as you said.
Right.
It really made that stand out.
I agree.
What else do you have for us?
The next clip is from a show that we did about a collaborative community art exhibit that took place at Raleigh's Visual Art Exchange. It was called Black on Black, and it invited artists of color to share their thoughts on identity and race. There were several artists on the program, and they were all great. I just needed to pick a theme here, so I was going with women, and so I chose only one of them to highlight today. And this is visual artist Sabotage. This whole art exhibit was in response to all the violence, the police violence against people of color that we saw over the summer. You know, we talked a lot about how do we have this conversation. This art exhibit, I thought, was a very productive way to talk about these experiences. And this is Sabotage talking about the work that she was showing in the exhibit.
The body of work that I completed in 2011 was called Technicolor Muslima and was really interacting with media representation of Muslim women in particular and wanting to interact with that and kind of flip it. And so I painted a number of American Muslim women that I was friends with who really embodied a kind of joy that I felt like could translate well onto a canvas, and painted it in really bright colors. And afterwards, it got a good amount of traction online. I think a lot of people saw it, and a lot of young Muslim women felt really connected to it. And a couple years later, I was included on a list of, like, American Muslim women to look out for. And there was a really glaring omission on that list in that there were no Black American Muslim women represented in that. And that was a moment of, I think, like big clarity on how just how to move forward and be more intersectional.
I wonder if that clarified, let me ask you if that clarified things for you. Did you suddenly examine maybe some assumptions that you had not challenged? In other words, was there a glaring absence in your own?
Absolutely. And especially within that body of work that I was, you know, communicating about in this particular way as a counterpoint to the typical representation, when in fact I was upholding certain omissions. And that was really problematic. And, you know, I think having a specific focus can be important, but that wasn't my intention going into this. So I felt like it was something that I needed to remedy and also call out and have a conversation around. So I sent out a call on my blog inviting folks to submit their own photographs of themselves to be included, and really specifically talking about what was wrong with that list that I was included on and what was wrong with the body of work that I'd put out there. And so I had over 60 strangers send in photos, which was beautiful, and also share something about themselves. I got a lot of really beautiful emails. And so these paintings, actually, like thinking about what Will was saying about painting people that you know, is I didn't know these women, but this process of painting them and even just interacting with them online was incredibly intimate.
That was artist Sabotage talking about her artwork, and she talked about it in a show that dated back to October of this year, and you can find out more about her work at artbysaba.com. All right, last but not least.
So last but not least is a film called Women Who Kill, and it was part of a show that I did about the Kukulores Film Festival in Wilmington. A lesbian murder mystery slash comedy. And what was so funny about it was that it just is a really hilarious wry send-up of life in Brooklyn, or really any kind of hipster lifestyle in any part of the country. It made me laugh out loud lots of times. And here's Ingrid talking about some of the themes of the film.
Themes are sort of where I start every project. So yes, they were all there. I wanted to talk about queer communities. I wanted to talk about feminism. I wanted to talk about sort of the binary approach, even within the LGBT community, and to show that we're all just sort of walking around lost in this world, and queer people, straight people, people of color, you know, we're all kind of trying to find our way. So I think that is a universal message.
That was filmmaker Ingrid Youngerman talking about her movie Women Who Kill. She is one of the female artists that producer Katie Barron enjoyed working with. Women and children were your theme, I think. Women and children, Katie.
I think you're right.
WWKmovie.com. That's where you'll find out more. And, of course, we have all this information at our website, stateofthings.org. Katie, this was fun. Thank you for doing this.
It's my pleasure.
Well, Katie's tenure goes back to 2006, though she has not been with us continuously from that time. But certainly back in the early days of our program, joining us now is a producer who has only been here since October, Laura Pelliser. Welcome.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's quite a pleasure. You are relatively fresh to the show and to this country, our nation.
Yes. Thank you very much for welcoming me.
Are you sure? Because just the minute you got here, this funny thing happened to us.
It's been very intriguing.
Yeah.
The election cycle is very short in Canada, so it's been an arduous experience, but very interesting. So, yeah, I'm originally from Montreal in Quebec, so everything is a little bit different.
Well, the good thing about this, doing this show, you will find, is that you'll learn a lot very quickly because of the amount of research you're going to have to do on various subjects. So let's talk about some of your favorite segments for this year that you have produced so far. Tell me about your favorite on tap right now.
I would say the first one that comes to mind is a conversation that we had about a new running group out of Wilmington called Black Man Running. I found out about the group after spending a lot of time on Facebook and a lot of time on Twitter and trying to prepare for this new job and this new endeavor and looking for stories, essentially. A photo of this running group popped up, so I dug into it a little bit. So we ended up producing this story, and it's really this story about what it means to move through public space as a person of color.
Of course, it was about a 20-minute segment, but maybe you can tell us about the clip we're going to hear.
Yeah, so we'll hear from Rendell Smith. He is the founder of the Black Man Running Group in Wilmington, and this story is about one of his very first running experiences.
I was definitely cognizant of the fact that there were certain racial politics out there. But, you know, I was 17. I was in Philadelphia. I was on my way to college. I was thinking about dropping a few pounds and decided that the best way to do that was to go out jogging, to go on a run. You know, and I'd seen this sort of archetypical running images over and over on television and sort of knew how to dress the part. So, you know, got the wristbands and threw a towel around my neck and, you know, got the right jogging pants and, you know, assumed that this kind of costume would allow me a safe passage through my neighborhood and the neighborhoods around me. So, you know, probably about six blocks out, I would say, I started getting different reactions in a predominantly white neighborhood. And that ultimately culminated in, you know, one woman just absolutely panicking at the sight of me running towards her and dropping her groceries and running in the other direction. Now, she only ran a few feet and kind of figured out what was going on and came back to her groceries and, you know, went about her routine. But it had certainly sort of taught me a lesson about how I would be perceived running as opposed to, you know, folks of various other backgrounds.
Well, it taught you a lesson or reinforced a lesson because it sounds like you had already taken on, I mean, this level of signaling that you felt you had to do. Look, I'm a jogger. See, sweatband, jogging clothes. In other words, you can't just put on some rags at the end of your bed and just go running. You had to think very deeply about what you were going to look like to prove that this is me running and jogging and not doing something else.
Right, and I think that that is something that, you know, almost all African Americans, and in particularly African American males, are taught to do. You know, very early on in the conversation that we began having about the value of Black lives, people began talking about the talk that Black parents give to their Black children. And this talk involves making them understand that when they are moving around in public space in this country, they are perceived differently, that they encounter different and various dangers as a result of being African American.
That's a clip with an interview with Rendell Smith, the founder of the group Black Man Running, an interview that originally aired in November. And I am here with producer Laura Pelliser looking back at some of her favorite shows. And that one, of course, started out with Rendell and his running group in Wilmington. But then we expanded that story. Tell us how you built that story out.
As you said, Frank, it started with this one narrow story about a very interesting running group and what they were doing out in Wilmington. But as I started speaking with people and digging in a little more, I found out that the running group had been coordinating with a researcher. He is a professor of sociology at the University of Maryland. His name is Ray Sean Ray, and he's been doing a lot of research into how stereotypes surrounding African Americans and exercise affect health outcomes.
Now let's hear a little bit of that interview with sociology professor at the University of Maryland, Ray Sean Ray.
When you look just at Americans in general, I think when we compare ourselves to other developing countries, we see that our health is not as good as others. When it comes to African Americans, it becomes even worse. I mean, we have higher rates of obesity, lower rates of physical activity, and that also comes with higher rates of chronic diseases, diabetes, high blood pressure, the likelihood of strokes. And so when we look at this as a whole, we see that there are issues as it relates to what it means to be Black in society, partly because of some of the things that we've heard from Rendell. And it also is coupled with the experiences that we have not only in public space, but at work, the types of neighborhoods that we live in. Most of the neighborhoods that African Americans live in, we oftentimes don't have access to the types of social resources and neighborhood resources that need to be available to actually live healthy and fulfilling lives. Part of that means we have fewer parks, we have fewer gyms, we have fewer healthy eating places. So you put all this together, and I think you said it earlier, your best, what we actually see is that exercising and being healthy in America is actually a privilege. And that's something that shouldn't be a privilege. Instead, it should be something that everyone should actually be able to take advantage of.
And how do men and women differ, or do they, in African-American communities when it comes to these health markers?
So when we look, when we compare black women to black men, what we see is that it depends on the outcome we're looking at. So the work that I've done is primarily focused on middle class blacks and whites. And I focused on that group because we still see health inequalities among blacks and whites, even at the middle class level. So I wanted to know, why is a higher social class status, why does having a bachelor's degree or having a good job and making good money or having a home, why do these things not matter as much for the health of African Americans? And one factor I found is that it has to do with the neighborhoods that individuals live in. So for example, for black men who live in predominantly white neighborhoods, what happens is that they're actually significantly less likely to engage in physical activity than if they live in predominantly black neighborhoods. Now, for black women, it's the exact reverse. For black women, we actually see that they are less likely to engage in physical activity in predominantly black neighborhoods. Now, the reason for these factors are different. For black women, it has to do with these with the normal things that we might think about, safety and more so perceptions of safety. So as a sociologist, I'm concerned with perceptions and social psychological measures. And we find that even if a neighborhood is safe, if people perceive that it's not, then that's going to affect the type of activities you're engaging in your neighborhoods. The other thing that women deal with is male-dominated spaces. So when you have fewer physical facilities to actually engage in physical activity, say only one park in a neighborhood or one gym, they become male-dominated. For black men, they actually face stereotypes and criminalization in predominantly white neighborhoods. And this criminalization means that, as Rendell was just describing, I mean, it's not only people running away, but it's people calling the police. It's people engaging in certain types of activities that actually deter people from engaging in physical activity. So for black men, they then go through a signaling process to try to signal that they belong. They engage in what we call impression management. They wear an alumnus t-shirt from their university. They always carry an ID. They run in places that are well lit. Things that you don't typically think about when you try to engage in exercise. And this leads to them being less likely to engage in physical activity.
That was University of Maryland sociology professor Rayshawn Ray talking about research into health outcomes in African-American communities, one of the segments that is a favorite of Laura Pelliser, a producer here on The State of Things, and our conversation with her will continue after this. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, and we are continuing our series of shows looking back at this past year. Today, hearing from a new State of Things producer, Laura Pelliser, about her favorite segments of this year. What did you bring next?
I wanted to highlight our conversation with Ruth Moose. She joined us in October to talk about her new book, Wedding Bell Blues. And as you know, Frank, it's a mystery novel. It's set in this small North Carolina town, suspiciously like Pittsburgh. And I picked this segment not so much about the story, but about Ms. Moose herself. So she is this incredible bundle of energy, and she was so fun to talk to in the pre-interview. She's this really great laugh. She's constantly interjecting with giggles. And towards the end of this interview, you know, usually thank our guest and you say, this is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Thank you for listening. And before we got off the air, she was out of studio. She was just so full of energy and she was thrilled with the interview, but she got out of her chair and just walked right out. I've never seen that happen before. So that was really fun.
Let's hear this part of our interview with writer Ruth Moose. A lot of these characters were, we got to know them in your first novel. What happens in the second novel and how do things change for them, or do they?
Oh, a lot of things happen. Well, small town, which a lot of people think is Pittsburgh, and they come to Pittsburgh looking for the Dixie Dew, which doesn't exist. Okay. But it's funny, there's a Motel 3 mentioned in both books, and there's an abandoned motel in Pittsburgh, and people think that's Motel 3. But in a small town, there's always, you know, sort of festivals and all kinds of things going on. I love small town newspapers. And so I have a green bean festival in this one. And that really comes from Stanley County, where I grew up, because people always said that green beans grew better in Stanley County than anywhere else.
And that we fact-checked that, by the way, pull it in fact if you want to go look that up. Tell me a little bit, you talked about this being a lot like Pittsburgh. You also have a food writer in here who we might recognize.
A lot of people have recognized her. And I'll have to tell you, Debbie Moose is, we're not related. And she says, we know each other. And she says people will tell her that they love her books, her novels and everything. And she said, fine, great. And people will tell me about a food column she's written, and they think I wrote it. And I say, oh, yes.
So, Debbie Moose is a food writer. Yeah.
Debbie Moose is a food writer, right. A wonderful food writer. And I called her when I was working on this book, and I said, can I put you in my new book? And she said, oh, that would be fun. And then I said, well, do you mind if I kill you?
There it is. Ruth Moose, as she's talking about her latest book, Wedding Bell Blues, a favorite interview of Laura Pelliser, who produced that segment. But in fact, the book was approved by us. You know, it was pitched and approved before you got here. And I will say that at the pitch meeting, someone said, oh, Ruth Moose has a new book. And before they got book out of their mouth, I just said, yes, absolutely. She's a wonderful writer. And as you can hear, a delightful person. So I'm glad you got to meet her and produce that segment. You also produced your first Monday Meet program for us, where we spent an entire hour getting to know someone interesting from North Carolina. What stood out for you in that experience of putting together a show like that?
Well, I got to produce this segment with Sanka Johnson. He is a biologist. He specializes in marine animals, and he's very, very interested in finding out how marine animals manage to hide in plain sight in the middle of the ocean. And what was really interesting about putting this together is you have to do a pre-interview for around 2 hours with someone, which means that you're working through all these questions about their life and you're trying to get to know them. But it's not so much a back and forth conversation, it's about listening. And after doing a 2-hour pre-interview with Sanka, I came out of this booth that I was recording in and I realized I had never listened to someone for 2 hours. And my brain was always thinking of a funny joke to say, or, you know, what am I going to talk about my own experiences with what he's mentioning? But that's not what it's about. It's about letting someone else guide the conversation.
Well, let's listen to the section of the conversation. As we spent an hour with Sanka Johnson, and here's a portion of that interview.
A problem when you're clear, even underwater, is that light can bounce off of you. I mean, you can think of this like if you go around with a flashlight at night and you shine it against a window pane, you see some light coming back, even though it's clear. And this is a problem underwater. And it's actually a problem in particular for people who design camera lenses, like those nice Nikon lenses and so on. And if you've ever looked at one of those ones closely, you'll see that they do reflect light, but it's sort of like very dim and it's sort of purple or kind of greenish. Right. And they put these coatings on things like glasses and so on. It's a special coating. Very, very thin coating, extremely thin, that stops the light from being reflected. Instead of it being reflected, it just keeps going on into the glass and makes the reflections a lot less. And so this would be a useful thing to have if you were a transparent animal. And so it looks like, you know, this one group of animals, there are particular sort of shrimpy-like animals that are pretty big and clear. They're a few inches long in some cases. They actually grow their own anti-reflection coating. Or at least they allow themselves to be colonized.
I was
going to
say, is it a colonization? Is it
microbes from
other animals that then inhabit them?
Yeah, so there are bacteria in the ocean, in the ocean everywhere. These little, in particular, these little round guys, really quite small. And they form on these animals these biofilms. And the animals, these particular shrimp, the biofilm is an extremely convenient sort of shape and set of, instead of just being like a big pile of bacteria all piled on top of each other, like the biofilms, let's say, in our gut, you know, that help digest some of our food. They're a perfect, thin, flat, single layer of little spheres that are all exactly the same size. So it's one, you know, species of bacteria. They're perfectly laid out flat. And it looks like the animals have some control over this because they don't grow over the eyes. And the end result, when, you know, you actually sort of work out the physics of this, is that they're the exact right refractive index and thickness to reduce pretty much all the reflected light from the animals. So they're sort of farming their own invisibility cloak.
You also look at cleaner shrimp, right, that signal other fish to stop. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, one. So
this is one of these neat interspecies interactions. You know, most of the time when we think about one species and another, we think about they're either competing or just one, frankly, eating the other.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, these two species have a relationship where these shrimp, a lot of times they live in little anemones in small groups. And then a fish will literally drive up. It looks like that because they're swimming just above the bottom. And they will stop. And the reason they stop is that a few of those little shrimp come up and they have these long white antennae and they start wiggling them in a really special way. That's almost like a signal, you know, come here. It's kind of like when people are cheering on the side of the road, you know, for a lemonade stand or come, we'll wash your car.
Your car wash.
Very much like that. It's like they're waving the car wash sign. And the ones that don't have the antenna, they have these long white arms and they clap. It's really adorable. And then the fish stops. The fish changes color. And it's like this little pair of signals has been exchanged. Then the shrimp approach the fish and like start opening up the gill area, opening up the mouth and so on. And they clean it. Like,
it's a pit stop.
It's a pit stop. They're cleaning the car. It looks for all the world like a pit stop. It's adorable. And so, you know, one of my students has been very interested in, you know, this sort of two-way visual communication. And a really funny thing about it is these cleaner shrimp they're beautiful. They have all these little colors. They have these little thin white antennae that they wave. You look at them, you just think, wow, these are really pretty cool. And of course, these cleaner shrimp have to theoretically see these fish coming in and so on. And so the first thing we did was we looked at their visual abilities. We assumed that they would have wonderful color vision, that their vision would be pretty sharp. And they're nearly blind. They have no color vision whatsoever. And their vision is so poor that, you know, the person with the worst, you know, glasses in the world, you know, still would see far better than these guys do. Everything to them looks like a blob. Like you just 5 feet away from me would be completely unrecognizable as even an object. I mean, let alone as a person or a human or an animal.
So what are they detecting? How do they know each other?
We don't know how they know each other at all. And it looks like the signals on, you know, that they have on their bodies, their white antennae, the patterns are entirely for other animals to recognize them. So I always sort of think of it as like, you know, this beautiful ballet dancer with a nice little costume dancing out this whole thing that they never get to see because they're blind, but everybody else can watch it.
And was this something that you all discovered or had you known about this and then you tried to focus on it for your research?
We knew that cleaner shrimp had been known for a while and a little bit about the signaling was known. Nothing was known about their visual abilities at all. It was assumed that their visual abilities might actually be pretty good. And like I said, a little bit was known that, you know, they sort of live in these little groups, but sort of the signals and how it goes back and forth and all that, no, that's what one of my students is sort of busily working on now. She goes to them, does some work in the lab, but then also goes to Curacao and the Red Sea and other places to watch them in nature do their thing and brings back tons and tons of GoPro videos.
How do you think your artistic sensibilities and experience inform your work or inform your approach to the work that you do now?
Yeah, for me, yeah, it matters a lot. Sometimes I feel a bit out of place as a scientist because I'm really drawn by the aesthetics of a question, more so often than any practical use. Though, funny enough, some of my things have ended up being very practical. You know, we do a lot of work that has ended up helping people with cataracts and so on. But I'm always drawn to things by their beauty, the underlying story, sometimes the, you know, the visual element of it. And so I choose things based on my own sort of love of it as an interesting thing, which maybe isn't that unusual, but we really a lot of times just don't take a very practical approach. And in the actual doing it, we do have a bit of a closet agenda that we want, you know, to sort of incorporate some art into the science in terms of the presentations, in terms of the figures we make for papers, in terms of movies and so on. We try to give people more than one way of understanding something, you know, to sort of do it in a beautiful way because not everybody responds well to just like a speech or responds well to a number of equations. Some people, they need to see it.
That's a clip from our conversation with Sanka Johnson about his life and career. Laura Pelliser produced the segment. She's been bringing us some of her favorites. You know, you talked about producing the meets and spending a couple of hours, and you say recording just for reference. I mean, obviously, he's here live doing the actual interview. But I think that demonstrates, you know, how much preparation really has to go into this. We really want to know kind of where a guest lights up, what really excites them, get the background and make sure that not only do we know the kind of where they're most excited and the most interesting parts of the conversation are, but that they have a good idea what to expect when they sit down in their chair. And so for that reason, I will say you and the other producers here are critical to the success of the show. So if those of you out there listening think you like the show, I will say if not for these producers doing that kind of work, it wouldn't happen. So thank you and all of them. So now, for your final pick, you've chosen music. Tell us about Mandolin Orange.
Yes, so I produced a segment with Mandolin Orange. That's the folk duo Emily France and Andrew Marlin. They came on our show to talk about their latest album, Blind Faller, which many people at WNC are big fans of. And what stood out for me in preparing for this was the pre-interview, because it was 10:30 in the morning when I called them for a pre-interview, and 10:30 in the morning is not the same for a journalist as it is for a musician. So I think it was a little bit rough. They admitted that they were on their first cup of coffee, and they managed to get through it. They toughed it out. And, you know, the interview was great. And I also had the opportunity to actually go to their show, very mesmerizing on stage. And at the show, it came full circle because they were talking about the interview that they had just had on WUNC.
Well, while they were here, they were talking about touring during the election. So let's hear a little bit of that conversation.
The main thing that we could detect just playing at our shows every night was just sort of an overall heightened sense of anxiety, I think, that everybody had. We started tour at the end of September and then got home right after the election. So it really was that last like month and a half. And there are a few songs on the new record that we feel like were born out of our own feelings surrounding the climate in the country right now. And so I do think when we were playing those songs every night, there seemed to be even more of a connection with the crowd, I think.
You had some anxiety about playing in Ann Arbor, Andrew, didn't you, the day after the election?
That was one of those shows that it could have gone many ways, but it definitely felt great to get on stage and play and just kind of put it all out, you know, just put it all out there. And I think, you know, we were talking about it, that it seemed like the people that came to the show were really excited to have a nice escape as well. And especially since some of these songs do deal with a lot of the issues happening right now around the country, I think it was a nice way to engage the crowd after such an intense election.
That's our clip from a conversation with Mandolin Orange. And Laura Pelliser produced that segment. She's been sharing her favorites with us this hour. And why don't we go out with a song, shall we?
Let's do it. So this is their live performance of Wildfire that they performed in studio for us.
Well, before we hear that, let me just say thank you very much for an excellent year, albeit a short one, but you'll have a whole year now to work your magic on this show. Laura Pelliser, thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
And you can find out more about our show at our website, stateofthings.org, which is also produced by Laura Lee and Anita Rao and Charlie Shelton Ormond and Katie Barron. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Widarski is helping out today. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow, and once again, Mandolin Orange.
Fill the eyes of their loved ones and their brothers and aunts. So it went for Joseph Warren. And it should have been different. It could have been easy. His reign could have saved him. But a country unborn needs bravery. And it spread like wildfire. Wildfire. Ashes grew sweet liberty, like the seeds of the pines when the forest burns. They open up to grow and burn again. And it should have been different. It could have been easy. Too much money rolled in to ever end slavery. The cry for war spread like wildfire. Thank you. wildfire. Wildfire. Civil War came, the Civil War went. Brother fought brother.